time, in the midst of the discussion of mystification. Mystification is at the core of what a lot of Marxian discussions of ideology are all about. That is, one of the purposes of a theory of ideology within the Marxist tradition is to try to help explain why people have so often inaccurate, unsatisfactory, or false understandings about how the world works. When people talk about false consciousness of workers, they mean many different things. One of the things they mean is that workers have false beliefs about how the world works. Sometimes false consciousness means workers don't have a correct understanding of their interests. But that's a little vague. Because it collapses two different problems. One problem is they may have false understandings about how the world works, and thus, on the basis of that, derive a false understanding of their interests. So if you believe, for example, that it's a natural order of things that capitalists are rich and workers follow their orders because the nature of a complex modern economy is such that the only conceivable way of organizing things is through private property, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, if you hold those beliefs, those are all beliefs about how the world works. They're all beliefs about the nature of things. You could conclude that struggling against capitalism is not in the interests of workers. Right? Now, that is different from a person who believes that the most important thing in their life is their national identity, and other things just don't matter to them. That their values and their sense of what's important is their solidarity with other Serbs. That's what really matters to them. And that it's on the basis of serving the interests of Serbia that they are going to organize their political practices. That's a different problem from the former one. You can believe that what's most important to you is your national identity and believe that capitalism is just one of many possible ways of organizing the world and it could be transformed. It's just that you don't care about that. What you care about is your national identity. The accusation that workers who vote on the basis of religion, you know, a worker who says that abortion is an abomination, it's killing children, I'm a deeply believing Christian and I'm going to vote and support political parties that reflect my identity and interests on religious grounds, that is a different problem of consciousness than a worker who votes for conservative parties that are anti-union and pro-business because they hold beliefs about the nature of capitalism. So the term false consciousness covers both of those ideas. Having non-class interests as your primary interest and having a false understanding of your class interests. I think those are fundamentally different problems. They may be psychologically connected. It may be by virtue of your unsatisfactory understanding of how capitalism works that you feel nothing can be done about your class situation, and therefore, perhaps, you gravitate towards other kinds of interests for political expression. That's possible. But that's only one of many possibilities. The issue of mystification in the Marxist tradition is primarily about false understandings of how capitalism works, about the nature of the social world in which we live. That's what it's primarily about. Occasionally, the idea of mystification and the associated idea of false consciousness is used to cover the other phenomenon, people having their sense of identity and interests displaced from class altogether. Some Marxist attacks on religion have that character, you know, where people who identify primarily around religion are seen as having false beliefs because of the claims about the falsity of religion itself. But I don't think that's the core of the theory. The core of the theory of ideology is really about distortions, unsatisfactory understandings about how the world itself works. Now, I think it's perfectly legitimate to criticize somebody's beliefs about how the world works as being wrong. You know, so the notion of false consciousness, when it's applied to this domain, that is, when it's applied to the set of beliefs about what exists and how things work, it's perfectly reasonable to say, no, that's not true, that's not how things work. And then you provide argument and evidence for how things really work. It's much more problematic to apply the criterion of, no, that's false, when the issue is people who have identities, when the issue is the kind of identity a person has. To say that your identity as a Serbian is false, what does that mean exactly? Well, it's a much more complicated set of claims. Serbia is a country, it has a history, people care about that history, they have traditions. It's a much trickier and more difficult thing to claim, no, your primary identity politically should be as a worker, not as a Serb. Well, it's not so simple. And as we know, nationalism, of course, has been a terribly hard thing to combat in working class movements. And time again, when a conflict between class interests and national interests under particular historical moments have occurred, people have been perfectly prepared, even strong and committed leaders to socialist movements have been perfectly prepared to subordinate class politics and class interests to national interests. We can label that false consciousness, but I don't think it clarifies anything to do so, or it doesn't clarify much. I'm mainly going to be talking then about mystification internal to the questions of class. Mystifications about what exists and how the world works. Yeah.
I'm kind of having difficulty with the way you're using false. Like when we were talking before, you were talking about, you know, there's a false conception of how the sun and that idea of false seems different from the idea of false that we're talking about with false consciousness.
No, I think I'm meaning something very similar here when I talk about how the world works.
I mean, how the world works in relation to the sun and the earth is demonstrable in a way that how the world works as far as classes operate doesn't seem to be as demonstrable.
It's not. The fact that there are more ambiguities and it's more difficult to establish the validity claims about social analysis makes it more vulnerable to robust mystification. I don't think that's a fundamental difference, however. When workers... Here's an example of what I consider false consciousness. In the early industrialization, workers smashed machines because they believed that it was machines that were putting them out of work. Right? So that you went from hand looms to machine looms, and the weavers felt the machines were the problem. Now, I would say that's a misdiagnosis. The machines in and of themselves could have liberated those weavers to be able to acquire their standard of living in 3 or 4 hours a day rather than 10 hours a day if they owned the machines. That the problem with the substitution of hand looms for machines was who owned them, the nature of the property rights around the machines, not the machines themselves. And that they had a misdiagnosis. They should have been smashing the heads of the capitalists rather than smashing the machines. Now, it could be that they, if they had the view, we know it's really the capitalists that are the problem, but we can't smash their heads. the best we can do is smash the machines. That'll give us a little room to maneuver. If that was their perspective, then I would say, no, they have perfectly good consciousness and they're making a strategic choice about how best to optimize their material conditions of life, given the constraints that they can't attack capital. But that isn't how they saw it. The way they saw it was, the problem was the machines themselves. And that's, you know, the machine wrecking anti-technology view has been, that was the kind of iconic case of that. Now I think it's perfectly, it's very much the same as the sun going around the earth. They see something in their immediate perception, in their lived experience of the moment, which is that they are displaced from work because a machine was introduced. That's like in your immediate direct experience, you see the sun setting. And they don't have a theory, an adequate theory, about how that individual experience could occur by virtue of a broader configuration of social forces or causes which make possible that individual experience. So in the Copernican case, what Copernicus does is say, aha, here is the broader set of causal forces of planetary movements that makes possible your experience of seeing the sun setting, while what's really happening is the Earth is rotating. So what Copernicus does is both explain the lived experience, you know, it doesn't deny it, he doesn't say you're hallucinating, you're not crazy to see the sun setting. He explains how you could experience it and how it could not be an accurate representation of the processes. That's what a sociological, Marxoid, you know, critical theory analysis of the machine problem in the early Industrial Revolution would say. Your lived experience on that shop floor, you were a weaver, you were working hard, providing for your family, and suddenly your looms are taken away and a power loom occurs and 90% of you are out of a job. You experience that as displacement by the machine, but that's a misdiagnosis because you don't understand the broader forces at work. And I think that's a correct identification of the causal processes involved, which a person wouldn't spontaneously have. It requires scientific work, basically.
The Copernican case is somewhat contained as a scientific principle. Whereas in a sociological case, as you keep extrapolating, there's the falsity might be in one of the more smaller nuances, but the further extrapolation, you still have more false true tension. You know, like, okay, so you say that they smashed the wrong thing, but then you can still extrapolate out to a bigger argument concerning capitalism versus socialism, you know, where that extrapolation doesn't really happen in a contained scientific sense in the Copernican revolution. You know, it's, well, once you understand the revolution of the planets, then you have, you know, then you have a contained scientific fact, and there's no more. So the falsity is contained in that science.
Yeah. So the thing was that. In the ideologies of nature, there were a couple of very pivotal junctures. There were kind of key lived experiences that people had, that once they were shattered, then it no longer was the case that people's lived experience interfered with the further development of scientific understanding. Right? So once you got rid of the insistence that whatever you experienced about the relative motion of celestial bodies had to be the true relative motion, once you broke that, which Copernicus did, then that opened the way for there to be debates about the expanding universe or the contracting universe, the Big Bang, I mean, all these things, in which nobody asks the question anymore, how does that relate to my lived experience? You know, people understand the scales and the time frames are completely disentangled from lived experience. The same thing with quantum mechanics. It's not an obstacle to quantum mechanics that we don't experience quantum jumps, right? Once you realize that your lived experience doesn't have to correspond to physical phenomenon at different scales, you're freed to study them on their own terms. And thus the advancement of science in the physical sciences proceeds, you know, with all sorts of fights and ambiguities. There's plenty of cases where the truth or falsity of particular theories is very ambiguous and continues for decades because it's hard to resolve. But it doesn't have this added part of being continually interfered with by the tyranny of lived experience, so to speak, as being a requirement. Now, in the social sphere, that isn't the case. Because human interests are so powerfully bound up with all of these theoretical positions, and because lived experience so deeply shapes our understanding of what the social world is, I think these battles have to be continually refought. And so you're right. The truth and falsity of beliefs about the world, the social world, are much less clear-cut in most cases. So some parts, I think, can be well nailed down, but other aspects can't be. And particularly on the question of big alternatives, you know, the idea that socialism is an alternative to capitalism. This is a theme of our weekend workshop. I mean, I believe that there are alternatives beyond capitalism. I feel that there's compelling evidence that that's possible. I don't believe it's compelling evidence of the same order that the Earth rotates on its axis and moves around the sun. I think there is serious room for disagreement that does not simply reflect unwillingness of people to face up to the facts of the matter. There's serious basis for disagreement for people to say, yes, well, there's the following four reasons why I believe it's possible to move beyond capitalism, and the following two reasons why I think this is not plausible, and I don't know how to weigh the four against the two. I don't believe that our knowledge base and our theoretical understandings are so sharply confirmed that you can say to somebody, no, those are false, your beliefs. Now that doesn't mean all you can do is sort of throw up your hands and say it's just a matter of opinion. There's weight to arguments, and there's weight to ways of proceeding how we can act given such uncertainty, as opposed to drawing the conclusion because of uncertainty there's nothing we can do, you know, in terms of transforming the world. But I do think you're right that as you move to bigger scales and broader visions, the accusation of falsity to some views becomes itself a false accusation, because as it's too strong an accusation. This is meandering a little bit, but I think no matter how committed you are as a socialist against capitalism, because of the seriousness of your understanding of the harms that capitalism imposes and the desirability for transcending it, nevertheless, it's incorrect to accuse somebody who disagrees with the view that it's possible to have a democratic, socialist, egalitarian alternative. It's not legitimate to say those views are false, because we just don't have a strong enough basis on a scientific basis to make that kind of validity claim about transcending capitalism. And therefore, that was a problem in the Marxist tradition. Marx wanted to have that degree of scientific certainty about the transcendability of capitalism. You know, that's what he thought he had achieved. And that degree of self-confidence was important for the communist movement and for Marxism as a theoretical perspective. I think it's Marxism functioning as ideology rather than as science, however, to affirm certainty about such propositions. I think it's overconfidence. It's an overstatement. It's not a scientifically grounded statement, that degree of confidence. It is scientifically grounded to talk about possibilities and about and it is scientific to criticize the equally false certainty that there is no transcendence possible. argument. So when pro-capitalists say, this is the only game in town, there's no other possibility, we've reached the end of history, that is equally ungrounded in scientific argument. So both positions of absolute certainty are themselves unsatisfactory. Okay, that's my homily for the day. But does that sort of answer the?
Yeah.
Okay. Are there any other follow-ups on? These are important issues, which I'm sure many of you have thought about. Some of you will have agonized about it various times. Any follow-ups on this? And then we. Okay, so mystification is really about distortions of how things really work. But they're distortions that then interfere with understanding how they really work. And distortions need not interfere with how you're understanding. So the mystification is the combination of distorted perception plus interference. That's why I gave the examples from the ideologies of nature, mystifications of nature. We no longer have a mystified understanding of the relationship between the Earth and the Sun, even though our perceptions haven't changed since medieval times. It's no longer a mystification, though, because of this huge epistemological break in our understandings of nature that occurred with Copernicus and then Darwin. Those are the two great breaks in our knowledge, in the epistemological sense, what it means to know something about nature, which basically freed our lived experience from this mystifying effect on our understanding. That kind of freeing is probably not possible as a general matter in social contexts, both because of the complexity of the things we're studying, but also because of the depth of our personal lived experience and our interests and identities that are connected to the social worlds in which we live. In the paradigm case of nature, the way I told the story is that there are certain spontaneous cognitions we have through our perceptions of the world, which we can then call lived experience, which then obscure the world unless we have an interpretive frame to block that obscuring. Right? So that's what Copernicus gives us for nature. It doesn't change our perception, it just prevents it from obscuring what's really going on. But at the first part is the spontaneously given lived experience, which then gets interpreted. In the nature case, we have pretty good confidence that the lived experience part can be distinguished from the interpretive part. Right? So, and that's because of our views about the physics and biology of optic nerves and perceptions and the way the human brain works, we're pretty confident that from the most simplest hunter-gatherer society to the most sophisticated cosmopolitan New Yorker, the experience of watching the sunset has been more or less the same, the lived experience. We think that is not something in which the actual experience of it is shaped by interpretation. What interpretation does is act on the experience. It's a little less obvious that that's true for our social experiences. And therefore, the concept of mystification as applied to the social context is not quite as straightforward. That is, it's not just that there's a distortion which then masks the reality, where what science does is breaks the masking. It's possible that our very perception of things in the first instance is shaped by social forces so deeply that the distortions are not simply lived experience, which then are in search of interpretations which may mask the reality. I think I don't have a clear resolution of that issue, if that issue is clear to you. You know, if I've said it clearly enough. If I haven't said it clearly enough, then it's still the case that I don't have a clear resolution. So in the machine wrecking case, my intuition is that there is a spontaneous sense in which if you lose your job after a machine is put in place, that your immediate gut feeling is the machine has displaced me. You know, the new technology comes in, half the workers lose their jobs. That the proximity of the cause and effect, and the fact that there is an actual connection, it is still true, it's not a false element of the causal process, that the new technology was one of the things that, under those contextual conditions, that led to your losing a job. I'm inclined to believe that the reaction that I've lost my job because of the machine is a lived experience.
So that's almost a natural?
Yeah, that's my intuition. So that's close to, it's close to, not, you know, I'm just saying it's close to the, because, to the sun setting, as it were. Because the causal, because everybody thinks in causal terms. I mean, hunter-gatherers, thinking that there are causes and effects is something that the psychologists of cognition have shown. Cause and effect thinking is hardwired. It's part of our neurological ability. All peoples in all parts of the world have causal analysis. They believe certain things generate certain effects. And that the proximity of a cause to its immediate effects is one of the ways that people identify cause-effect relations. So that's both in the natural world. If you strike a match against a hard surface and it lights up, everybody is going to, even if they don't know what the mechanism is, are going to feel that the flame comes from striking the match against the surface. But they might have different explanations. Some might believe that there's a little demon, you know, in the head of the match, which gets excited and sets it in flame, and other people might understand how phosphorus works. But in both cases, the cause and effect relationship between the striking and the flame, because of proximity and temporal ordering, are the two things which people use to intuit causation. And that seems to be hardwired. That's a cultural universal. And that's why I say it's at least getting close to a spontaneous experience, which then needs interpretation in order for it to be given meaning for purposes of social action or whatever. Yeah.
But isn't it totally different if there's a, you know, a demon, like you said, causing it? I.e., it seems that it's always going to be interpreted depending on a particular religious or other worldview.
The demon gives an account for how the causal mechanism works, but not that it's the fact that it's the striking of the match against the surface that generates the flame. That's true whether it's demons or phosphorus. So you can have a belief in karma and fate, which means that you lose your job because of the technology and you say that's fate. But you still believe that there still is, I would argue, a spontaneous causal understanding of that connection between the introduction of the technology and the losing of the job. And the counterfactual there is, if the technology had not been introduced, I would not have lost the job. Karma may explain why the technology was introduced, and it might explain why you and not some other worker lost their job when it was introduced. You know, those are additional interpretive elements. But that basic connection is something which is given spontaneously by our cognitive capacities. That's my intuition anyway. I mean, I can't prove that, but and that's why I think there is the analogy with the ideologies of nature. Now, why do I go through all this? I think Marx's analysis of commodity fetishism has that character. He's basically saying, you take any human being and you put them in this kind of social relationship enough so that they understand how, you know, they understand the rules of the game, they know how to function in it, and they will come to have fetishized understandings of spontaneously. You don't have to be taught that. You don't need discourses of instruction to experience commodity fetishism or capital fetishism. You can then have those beliefs demystified with proper scientific understanding. That is, you can come to realize, aha, oh, that's why I have that experience. Through a proper understanding of how the system really works, and that's why science was needed. But the direct production of commodity fetishism is in a sense, a cognitive psychology claim on Marx's part about how people come to experience life in a world where commodities exchange on markets and are seen, experienced as having powers which they don't really have. And the same for capital fetishism. Fetishism is one comment before I elaborate that. Last time I very briefly gave as other examples of mystification how people explain poverty and how people explain crime. I also think that those explanations are deeply connected to a lived experience, spontaneous cognition element. That is, if you live in a world where some people who are born poor become non-poor and some people stay poor, there's a spontaneous, I think, explanation that comes through this kind of cognitive process of inferring causation, that there must be some difference between the two people. You know, two people who start out the same and end differently, why? It's because there's something about them that are different. There are many possible candidates for what's different, but the identification of the explanation as inhering in the attributes of the person is something I think is spontaneous and natural. Does not require social tutelage. You don't have to be taught that. That's something which a cognitively intact person observing the world will spontaneously believe, that two people that start out alike and end up different, there must be something different about them. The extension from that to an explanation of poverty is more complicated. That is, doesn't automatically follow that from that individualistic explanation of individual difference, you get an explanation of poverty as such. I think that that extension probably does require tutelage. And therefore, that extension is probably not a pure example of what I'm calling mystification. Remember, what a pure example of mystification is, where there's a spontaneous lived experience which leads to a distortion in the absence of something which corrects the distortion, right? So you need science to break the link between the lived experience and the masking of the reality. Yeah.
But, I mean, what I would have assumed is that, like, with respect to the poverty explanation, the idea to focus on personal attributes as explanatory isn't spontaneous, but rather is a product of, say, like, individualist ideology.
Yeah, so
whereas someone trained, say, in like the Soviet Union, not trained in like individualist explanation, but rather perhaps in like structural explanation, would immediately or seemingly spontaneously go to the kind of structural.
Right. So, although I would argue that even in somebody strongly trained in the structural collective explanations, when they see one person commit crimes and another not from the same family, would attribute the difference, the explanation for that behavioral difference, to something about the differences between those persons. Right, that would. And then the question is, I do think that the extension of that to social explanations requires ideology. That isn't a spontaneous product. Let me turn to the fetishism. The term fetish comes from anthropological discussions. I don't know in Marx's own usage whether he was drawing it from academic anthropology of the time or whatever, it wasn't called anthropology in the first part of the 19th century. So I don't know the exact pedigree of his use of the term fetishism, but in anthropology, a fetish is defined as some object to which powers are ascribed by people. People see powers in an object, which the object doesn't inherently have. The object has powers only because people attribute powers to it. So people have, can have a carved animal which they carry with them because they believe it protects them. Well, the carved animal doesn't actually protect anybody, the argument would be. There's no powers in that carved animal. The belief that the carved animal can protect you can help protect you because it can give you a more less anxious place in the world, and lower anxiety, maybe self-protective. So just as in the case of the Malinowski fishing rituals, the rituals don't actually bring the gods on your side to keep the dangers of the open sea down, at least most modern scientists believe that the rituals don't actually affect the weather, but they may indeed make fishing safer by virtue of giving people more confidence that they'll get through a bad situation, and that greater confidence may in fact make fishing safer. Plus, of course, it may give you the confidence to actually do the dangerous fishing which is needed for the community. Well, the same thing is true for token fetishes. So the general idea of fetishism is attributing power to something which it does not inherently have, a misattribution of power. And that's what both commodity fetishism and capital fetishism are meant to designate. The attribution of powers to commodities and to capital which don't actually inhere in power in commodities and capital as such. It's a misattribution of power. Cohen, in Karl Marx's Theory of History, in a section which you'll read later, I don't think that was assigned. Was that assigned for this part? I don't think so. It was?
115 to 130.
Okay. So I think Cohen has a very nice discussion of fetishism and how it works. It appears, he writes, that people labor because their products have value, whereas in fact they have value because labor has been bestowed on them. So there's this misattribution of causal power to the commodity, which actually inheres in the laboring activity of people. Commodities appear to have power of their own, autonomous from the producers, but actually commodities only have value, that is their power to command other values in the market by virtue of the labor of producers. Similarly for capital, it appears to have power of its own, independent of its conditions of existence. It appears that capital as such generates profits. This leads economists to see capital and labor as each generating profit, as each having a return, whereas Marx argues that actually profits are generated by labor, not by capital, and that this is a misattribution of power. Of the true power to generate profit comes from the exercise of laboring effort, not from the existence of inert capital. Now, in both the commodity fetishism and capital fetishism case, these attributions of power, Marx would argue, comes spontaneously from people's lived experience in a world where commodities circulate and capital is invested. If you live in that world, your spontaneous experience of what happens when you invest a certain amount of capital is that you get a return for it. And it appears that the capital is generating the return. In the absence of some countervailing explanation that's provided through a scientific understanding of how economic systems works, therefore, that lived experience would mask the reality. The lived experience is a distortion which masks reality in the absence of some knowledge, some systematic knowledge, which leads you to understand what the real generative process is of the profits that are associated with those returns. Marx believed that the labor theory of value provided that. Mystification, understood in this way, are distortions of reality, but they're not hallucinations. And demystification, therefore, needs to always be understood as a process which both explains the lived experience and provides the correcting causal explanation. Right? So a demystification process doesn't deny the lived experience. Demystification doesn't say, no, you're hallucinating. Demystification says, aha, I can explain both why you perceive the world this way and why it actually works differently. And the reason I return to the Copernicus case is because it's such a clean case of that process. Copernicus explains both why it is that people see the sun setting and why the Earth is actually rotating. Both things have to be part of a demystifying process. I think, in some ways, with respect to the kinds of problems we're discussing, the most fundamental aspect of social mystification is the belief that people hold that that existing social rules and relations are inevitable or natural or eternal. Right? So that the belief that people hold that the way we do things in the world today, the kinds of relations in which we live, in gender relations, for example, or in market relations, that these are natural, that they're not socially constructed, and therefore they're inevitable. That set of beliefs is the kind of mystification which is the most damaging to transformative projects. The thing which blocks transformation more than anything, the beliefs that block transformation more than anything, are simply the belief that nothing else is possible. This is why I think the crucial kind of demonstration, the crucial kind of evidence that can be provided that helps to demystify the inevitabilist view of the natural, of the social as natural, is attempts at actually producing alternatives, which show that alternatives, that another world is possible. This can either be done through revolutionary transformations, where the Soviet Union, for all of its flaws, had this world historical importance of demonstrating that some alternative was possible. You might not like it. You might reject the Soviet model as authoritarian and oppressive, but it was a palpable demonstration that the way things existed were not the only possible way of doing things. So the mystification that comes from the mundane, everyday life experience of the world as natural, as given, as already there, the demystification of that was presented by the manifest existence of an alternative. And then one could debate whether a better alternative was possible. The existence of the Soviet Union had this positive effect on public discussion about capitalism, that the key idea that an alternative system was viable was demonstrated on the ground. And then the issue was, well, could it be made democratic and open as opposed to repressive? And while some people said no, you know, there was always the view that anything other than a capitalist democracy would end up totalitarian. That view was did not have the weight that the view that there is no possible alternative at all has now. The idea that there's no possible alternative because all we see everywhere is capitalism has a strong correspondence to, I think, again, a certain aspect of lived experience. That is where you live in a world which constantly reinforces your sense that the social world has a natural character to it. The social production of functioning alternatives, this is on page 4, the actual production of alternatives is one of the basic ways of struggling against the mystification of the existing society as the only possible society. In a sense, I think one, from the kind of scientific point of view, invoking Copernicus again, building alternatives should be treated as experimental evidence against the proposition that the social world as we know it is a natural world. It's the way you provide evidence to people that alternative ways of doing things in which lives could be better are possible. Okay, let me just go towards let me wrap up the mystification discussion with this brief discussion of functionalism and mystification. One view of mystification is that somehow systems necessarily produce the kinds of distortions needed for those systems to be reproduced. Capitalism somehow secretes spontaneously precisely those distortions which are optimal for the reproduction of capitalism. There's a tendency in critical perspectives, Marxist included, for the mystifications of the existing world to be seen as always functional for the reproduction of the existing world. And that they are that the distortions which are spontaneously produced, like capital fetishism and commodity fetishism, that those distortions are also functional for reproduction of capitalism. I don't think that that kind of functionalist explanation is very satisfactory for ideology, for some of the same reasons that it wasn't satisfactory for the discussion of politics as well. First of all, mystification distorts the perceptions of elites as well as oppositional forces, the bourgeoisie as well as the proletariat. The spontaneous distortions of how capitalism works affect the thinking of all people in the society. Fetishism is not something that is differentially applied to workers and not capitalists. It prevents the bourgeoisie and the state from understanding adequately the way capitalism works, and it impedes their own rationality. Now, it may be that it's a more serious problem for workers, for challengers, to have their understanding of how a system works impeded than for defenders of a system. It may be, all things considered. If everybody's going to be confused about how the world works, this is a bigger impediment for challengers to a system than defenders of a system. But that's not obvious. It's not obvious that that's the case. There could certainly be cases where the contradictions of the existing system could be countered by far-sighted understandings of how capitalism works and what is needed to restore it to stability, which are blocked by the mystifications of capitalism, and which lead defenders of capitalism to adopt all sorts of completely stupid policies that are self-destructive, and which lead to cataclysmic results. Arguably, that kind of mystification for how capitalism works was one of the problems of the Great Depression. That is, the initial reaction to the Great Depression, some of the initial reactions were to cut back public spending and to raise tariffs to protect one's own industries in an international economy. Right, so tariffs went up and government spending went down. And many people argue that the Depression was actually caused by those reactions. Both of those reactions, I would argue, are the result of mystification. The idea that when you face, if you're in, I'm speaking within the parameters of capitalism now. So if you're a capitalist in capitalism, the idea that the best way to protect your economy, to get it back in place in the context of a business cycle, a severe business cycle, is to raise very high tariff barriers to reduce competition. That's a spontaneously given cause and effect relation, because you see a competitive threat to your own business, and the way to do it is to protect yourself. But you're actually, it's a collective action problem, it's a prisoner's dilemma, because other countries respond in the same way. The result is a reduction of trade all around, which causes a more generalized crisis than would have otherwise been the case. Prisoner's dilemmas are a good example of this kind of problem. The spontaneous understanding in a disorganized system of each actor is that they should defect from cooperation. That's their best strategy. And the absence of an understanding of the aggregate consequences of that, that leads to a intensification of the crisis tendencies. That is an example of mystification, of the mystification of the elite, caused by the workings of capitalism. That is, they did not have an adequate theory that would counter the spontaneous causal relations that they would see would serve their interests. They had false ideas about what would serve their interests because they didn't have a good theory of how the system as a whole worked. The ideas about the system were all merely generalizations from their local experience, their partial and immediate views of what was a threat to their profitability rather than an understanding of the conditions of possibility for the profitability of a system. So mystification can harm elites as well as masses in the elite's case in their attempt to reproduce a system, in the masses' case in their attempts to transform systems. Once you drop the notion of automatic functionality of mystification, that is, once we no longer say that mystification always spontaneously serves the interests of dominant classes, and we treat it as a property of social complexity and social systems, then I think it shifts our understanding of the problem of demystification, gives focus to that problem, by focusing our attention on the institutional obstacles, the mechanisms that are in place that block our ability to demystify these relations. So this is at the bottom of page 4. I explain the contrast. So rather than simply asking the question, what is it in people's daily practices which distorts their cognitive maps of the society? What is it in everybody, in people's daily lives, which give them distorted perceptions? We also need to ask the question, what are the obstacles or mechanisms or processes which block the process of demystification, which obstruct challenges to mystification? The question is, what blocks the ability to have broader and more generalized scientific understandings on the part of masses or on elites, if you're studying elites, for them to understand the workings of the system in which they live. And this is what brings us to the question of ideological apparatuses, the machinery of propagating particular belief systems and blocking others. The educational systems in the United States, for example, which have systematically silenced for most of the last 100 years, systematically silenced in educational systems critical beliefs about the nature of capitalism and how it works, It's not that it's been totally repressed, but it's been marginalized. Very few high schools, for example, will have a systematic unit giving thoughtful and careful attention to the critique of capitalism, along with all the other stuff. So it's a question of the silencing is the lack of serious pluralism in the perspectives that are presented. Would be an example of how an ideological apparatus, a particular machinery for disseminating particular ideas, makes it harder for demystifying ideas to gain traction. So it's as if the Catholic Church did this in the early modern period. Catholic Church, for 50 years or so, was quite successful in keeping Copernican and Galilean ideas from gaining much traction. Maybe 100 years, actually. Copernicus was before Galileo, so it was 50 years after Galileo that people were still severely punished as heretics, like burned at the stake, for supporting those kinds of ideas. That's pretty clear-cut repression. By an apparatus that wants to propagate particular beliefs, and the form of that repression is blocking demystification. I think that's the way to think about what ideological apparatuses do. That's also in keeping with Offie's view of negative selection, that is, negative selection is about exclusion. So what's being excluded are the kinds of theories and understandings that people could have which would contribute to demystification, so that people could properly diagnose the source of various harms that they experience. Ideological struggle in these terms is struggle over these apparatuses. What it means to engage in ideological struggle is to struggle over the apparatuses in order to enhance the possibility of disseminating demystifying frameworks. Broadly speaking, that means struggling within universities and within high schools and within other media to make possible the critique of capitalism as having the same airtime, so to speak, and the same space in people's understanding of possible ways of understanding the world as does the defense of markets and the defense of capitalism. Now, liberal democracies have this peculiar character. It's what Marcuse called repressive tolerance, which they allow enough openness, there are enough venues in which you can say whatever you want to, that the very claim that this is being systematically excluded is itself mystified. Right? People believe, if you believe that you live in an open and free intellectual environment, then the claim that the reason why more people don't share my beliefs is because they haven't been properly exposed to them sounds like special pleading, just whining. I'm just complaining that my ideas haven't gotten proper dissemination because the machinery of dissemination is biased against me. Yeah.
Who wrote that? Who?
Marcuse. Herbert Marcuse. M-A-R-C-U-S-E. One Dimensional Man is his most famous book. And he has this term, repressive tolerance. Which was deliberately an oxymoron. The idea was that it's a form of tolerance which actually represses alternatives by giving just enough credibility, basically, to the full spectrum of ideas, since anything can be said, but not anything can be said with equal capacity for dissemination. Ultimately, then, I think the issue of mystification should be the primary focus should be on the obstacles to demystification. And that when people talk about ideological apparatuses, the machinery of the media, of education, of the press and so on, and want to study their role in the perpetuation of distortions, it's mostly, the most crucial aspect is their role in preventing demystifying perspectives from being taken seriously and given equal weight. And that's as opposed to seeing ideological apparatuses as mainly just straightforward propaganda in favor of the system. Of course, that's present as well, but I think the more really crucial aspect is the exclusion of demystifying perspectives. All right. I think we should take our break and then we'll launch into hegemony. Another big and fraught topic.